starting now.
Black Clock Audio Tales, May 2019, Hawaiian Folklore and Legends, edited by Daniel Spitzer, music by Kevin MacLeod. Help the show by sharing, rating, liking, or five-star giving wherever you listen to or rate podcasts. Support the show by hitting the patron button on pgttcm.podbean.com or by going to paypal.me/pgttcm, and don't forget to visit pgttcm.com. Brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Check out their new Dino Sound Slippers. Is that the name? They roar every third step. Very cool.
March 2018. The Legends and Myths of Hawaii by King David Kalakaua. Chapter 4. Hina, the Helen of Hawaii. Characters: Hakalani Leo, a chief of Hawaii. Hina, wife of Hakalani Leo. Uli, a sorceress, mother of Hina. Niheu and Kana, sons of Hina. Kamauaua, king of Molokai. Keolo Eva and Kaupeepe, sons of Kamauaua. Nuakea, wife of Keolo Eva. Moi, brother of Nuakea. Hina, the Helen of Hawaii, a story of Hawaiian chivalry in the 12th century. Section 1. The story of the Iliad is a dramatic record of the love and hate, wrong and revenge, courage and custom, passion and superstition of mythical Greece, and embraces in a single brilliant recital events which the historic bards of other lands, lacking the genius of Homer, have sent down the centuries in fragments. Human nature has been substantially the same in all ages, differing only in the ardor of its passions and appetites, as affected by the zone of its habitat and its peculiar physical surroundings. Hence, almost every nation, barbarous and civilized, has had its Helen and its Troy, its Paris and its Agamemnon, its Hector and its demigods. And Hawaii is not an exception. The wrath of no dusky Achilles is made the thesis of the story of the Hawaiian abduction. But in other respects, the Greek and Polynesian legends closely resemble each other in their general outlines. The story of Hina, the Hawaiian Helen, and Kaupeepe, the Paris of the legend, takes us back to the 12th century, near the close of the second and final era of migration from Tahiti, Samoa, and perhaps other islands of Polynesia, a period which added very considerably to the population of the group and gave to it many new chiefs, a number of new customs, and a few new gods. That the tale may be better understood by the reader who may not be conversant with the legendary history of the Hawaiian Islands, it will be necessary to refer briefly to the political and social condition of the group at that time. Notwithstanding the many sharply drawn and wonderfully preserved historic legends of the Hawaiians, the early settlement of the little archipelago is shrouded in mystery. The best testimony, however, warrants the assumption that the islands were first discovered and occupied by a people who had drifted from southern Asia to the islands of the Pacific in the first or second century of the Christian era, and by migratory stages from the Fijis to Samoa and thence to Tahiti, had reached the Hawaiian group in about AD 550. The first discovery was doubtless the result of accident, but those who made it were able to find their way back to the place from which they started, either Tahiti or Samoa, and in due time return with augmented numbers, bearing with them to their new home pigs, fowls, dogs, and the seeds of such fruits and vegetables as they had found to be wanting there. The little colony grew and prospered, and for nearly 500 years had no communication with or knowledge of the world beyond. At the end of that time, their geographical traditions had grown so faint that they spoke only of Kahiki, a place very far away from which their ancestors came. First landing on the large island of Hawaii, They had spread over the 8 habitable divisions of the group. The people were ruled by district chiefs, in 5 to a supreme head on some of the islands and on others independent. And the lines dividing the masses from the nobility were less strictly drawn than during the centuries succeeding. Wars were frequent between neighboring chiefs, and popular increase was slow. But the taboos of the chiefs and priests were not oppressive, and the people claimed and exercised a degree of personal independence unknown to them after the 11th century. In about AD 1025, or perhaps a little earlier, the people of the group were suddenly aroused from their long dream of 6 centuries by the arrival of a large party of adventurers from Tahiti. Their chief was Nanamaoa. Their language resembled that of the Hawaiians, and their customs and religions were not greatly at variance. They were therefore received with kindness, and in a few years their influence began to be felt throughout the group. They landed at Kohala, Hawaii, and Nanamaoa soon succeeded in establishing himself there as an influential chief. His son secured possessions on Maui and Oahu, and on the latter island, one of them, Nanakaoko, instituted the sacred place called Kukaniloko in the district of Ewa, where it was the desire of future chiefs that their sons should be born. Even Kamehameha I, as late as 1797, sought to remove his queen thither before the birth of Liholiho, but the illness of the royal mother prevented. This became the sacred birthplace of princes, as Iao in Wailuku Valley, on the island of Maui, became their taboo spot of interment. It was at Kukaniloko that Kapawa, the son of Nanakaoko, was born. His principal seat of power was probably on Hawaii, although he retained possessions on Maui and Oahu. It was during his life that the celebrated chief and priest Paao made his appearance in the group. He came from one of the southern islands with a small party, bringing with him new gods and new modes of worship. And to him, the subsequent high priests of Hawaii traced their sacerdotal line, even down to Hewahewa, who in 1819 was the first to apply the torch to the temples in which his ancestors had so long worshipped. Paao was a statesman and warrior, as well as a priest, but he preferred spiritual to temporal authority. And when Kapawa died and was buried at Iao, leaving his possessions without a competent ruler and his subjects in a state bordering upon anarchy, Paao did not assume the chieftaincy, as he manifestly might have done, but dispatched messengers, if indeed he did not go himself, to the land of his birth, to invite to Hawaii a chief capable of restoring order. Such a leader was found in Pilikaekae of Samoa, who migrated to Hawaii with a goodly number of retainers, and was promptly established in the vacant sovereignty, while Paao continued in the position of high priest. Pili extended his authority over the 6 districts of Hawaii, but beyond Kohala and the northern part of the island, the recognition of his sovereignty was merely nominal, and internal wars and revolts were frequent. The next arrivals of note from the southern islands were the 2 Paumakua families, one of which settled in Oahu and Kauai, and the other in Hawaii and Maui. Whether, as averred by conflicting traditions, they arrived contemporously or 2 or 3 generations apart is a question in no wise pertinent to our story. The legend is connected with the Hawaii branch alone, and the order of their coming need not therefore be here discussed. The Paumakua family, which became so influential in Hawaii and Maui, arrived during the early part of the reign of Pili in about AD 1090. A large party accompanied the family, and they brought with them their gods, priests, astrologers, and prophets. They first landed and secured possessions in Maui, but the sons and other relatives of Paumakua were brave and ambitious, and soon by conquest and marriage secured an almost sovereign footing both in Maui and Hawaii. One of the nephews of Paumakua, Hakalani Leo, who was the son of Kuhea Ilani, as an entering wedge to further acquisitions, became in some manner possessed of a strip of land along the coast in the district of Hilo, Hawaii. It was a large estate, and the owner availed himself of every opportunity to extend its boundaries and increase the number of his dependents. His wife was the beautiful Hina of Hawaiian song and daughter of the seeress Uli, who had migrated from Tahiti with some one of the several expeditions of that period, possibly with the Paumakua family, although tradition does not so state. At that time, Kamauaua, a powerful chief of the ancient native line of Nanaula, held sway over the island of Molokai. He proudly traced back his ancestry to the first migration in the 6th century, and regarded with aversion and well-founded alarm the new migratory tide which for years past had been casting upon the shores of the islands a flood of alien adventurers, whose warlike and aggressive chiefs were steadily possessing themselves of the fairest portions of the group. He had sought to form a league of native chiefs against these dangerous encroachments, but the wily invaders, with new gods to all the masses, and new customs and new traditions to charm the native nobility, had, through intermarriage and strategy rather than force, become the virtual rulers of Hawaii, Maui, Oahu, and Kauai, and he had abandoned all hope of seeing them supplanted. Molokai alone remained exclusively under native control, and its resolute old chief had from their infancy instilled into his sons a hatred of the southern spoilers and a resolution to resist their aggressions to the bitter end. The eldest of the sons of Kamauaua was Kaupeepe. He was a warlike youth, well skilled in arms and mighty in strength and courage, and so profound was his detestation of the alien chiefs that he resolved to devote his life to such warfare as he might be able to make upon them and their subjects. With this view, he relinquished his right of succession to his first brother, Keoloewa, and gathering around him a band of warriors partaking of his desperation and courage, established a stronghold on the promontory of Haupu, on the north side of the island, between Pelekunu and Waikolo. At that point, and for some miles on each side of it, the mountains hug the ocean so closely as to leave nothing between them and the surf-beaten shores, but a succession of steep, narrow, and rugged promontories jutting out into the sea, and separated from each other by gorge-like and gloomy little valleys gashing the hills, and like dragons, forever swallowing and ejecting the waves that venture too near their rocky jaws. One of the most rugged of these promontories was Haupu. It was a natural fortress, precipitously fronting the sea with a height of 500 feet or more, and flanked on the right and left by almost perpendicular declivities rising from narrow gulches, choked with vegetation, and sweetening the sea with rivulets of fresh water dashing down from the mountains, seamed by their sources. It was connected with the range of mountains back of it by a narrow and rising ridge, which at a point something less than a mile inland, where opposite branches of the two flanking gulches approached each other closely, was contracted to a neck of not more than 50 paces in width. The summit of the point abutting the ocean was a comparatively level plateau, or rather series of three connecting terraces, embracing in all an area of nearly 100 acres. Surrounded on three sides by almost perpendicular walls and accessible on the fourth only by a narrow and easily defended ridge extending to the mountains, little engineering skill was required to render the place well-nigh impregnable. Setting himself earnestly to the task, Kaupeepe soon transformed the promontory of Haupu into one of the strongest fortresses in all the group. He surrounded the plateau with massive stone walls overlooking the declivities, and across the narrow neck leading to the mountains, raised a rocky barrier 10 feet in thickness and 20 feet in height, around which aggression from without was rendered impracticable by the excavation of precipices leading to, and in vertical line with, the ends of the wall. Instead of a gate, a subterranean passageway led under the wall, the inside entrance being covered in times of danger with a huge flat stone resting on rollers. Although the passage was rough, and in unfavorable weather attended with danger, canoes could enter the mouths of both gulches and be hauled up beyond the reach of the waves and beyond the reach of enemies as well. For above the entrances and completely commanding them, frowned the broad battlements of Haupu, from which might be hurled hundreds of tons of rocks and other destructive missiles. With ingenuity and great labor, narrow footpaths were cut leading from the middle terrace to both gulches, some distance above their openings, and affording a means of entering and leaving the fortress by water. These paths connected with a terrace through narrow passageways under the walls, and a single arm could defend them against a host. Within the walls, buildings were erected, capable of accommodating in an emergency 2,000 or 3,000 warriors. And on the lower terrace occupied by Kaupeepee and his household, including his confidential friends and captains, a small heiau overlooked the sea, with a priest and 2 or 3 assistants in charge. Mountain paths led from the fortress to Kalaupapa and other productive parts of the island. And as fish could be taken in abundance, and Kaupeepee and many of his followers controlled taro and other lands in the valleys beyond, it was seldom that the stronghold was short of food, even when foraging expeditions to the neighboring islands failed. The services of the courageous alone were accepted by Kaupeepee, and it was a wild and daring warfare that the little band waged for years against the alien chiefs and their subjects. They could put afloat 100 war canoes, and their operations, although usually confined to Oahu, Maui, and Hawaii, sometimes in a spirit of bravado, extended to Kauai. Leaving their retreat, they hovered near the coast selected for pillage until after dark, and then landed, and mercilessly used the torch and spear. This part of their work was quickly done, when they filled the canoes with the choicest plunder they could find or of which they were most in need, and before daylight made sail for Haupu. Women were sometimes the booty coveted by the buccaneers, and during their raids many a screaming beauty was seized and borne to their stronghold on Molokai, where in most instances she was so kindly treated that she soon lost all desire to be liberated. Occasionally they were followed, if the winds were unfavorable to their retreat, by hastily equipped fleets of canoes. If they allowed themselves to be overtaken, it was for the amusement of driving back their pursuers. But as a rule, they escaped without pursuit or punishment, leaving their victims in ignorance alike of the source and motive of the assault. A prominent chief of Oahu, whose territory had been ravaged by Kaupeepee, traced the retiring fleet of the plunderers to the coast of Molokai, when it suddenly disappeared. He landed and paid his respects to the venerable Kamauaua, then at Kalaupapa, and craved his assistance in discovering and punishing the spoilers, who must have found shelter somewhere on the island. The old chief smiled grimly as he replied, "It is not necessary to search for your enemies. You will find them at Haupu, near the ocean. They are probably waiting for you. They do not disturb me or my people. If they have wronged you, land and punish them. You have my permission." The Oahu chief offered his thanks and departed. He made a partial reconnaissance of Haupu, ascertained that it was defended by but a few hundred warriors, and shortly after returned with a large fleet of canoes to capture and retain possession of the place. Arriving off the entrance to the gulches and discovering a number of war canoes drawn up on their steep banks, he opened the campaign by ordering their seizure. 60 canoes filled with warriors rowed the surf into the gulches, where they were met by avalanches of rocks from the walls of the fortress, which dashed the most of them in pieces. The chief was startled and horrified, and believing the gods were raining rocks down upon his fleet, he rescued such of his warriors as were able to reach him from the wrecked canoes and hastily departed for Oahu, not again to return. It is said that Kamauaua watched this assault upon Haupu from the hills back of the fortress, and in token of his pleasure at the result, sent to Kaupeepee a feather cloak, and gave him the privilege of taking fish for his warriors from one of the largest of the royal ponds on the island. He also quietly presented him with a barge, than which there were few larger in the group. It would accommodate more than 100 warriors and their equipments, and was intended for long and rough voyages. These barges were constructed of planks, strongly corded together over a frame and caulked and pitched. They were sometimes 10 or more feet in width, and were partially or wholly decked over with a depth of hold of 6 or 8 feet. It was in vessels of this class, and in large double canoes of equal or greater burden, that distant voyages were made to and from the Hawaiian Islands during the migratory periods of the past, while the single and double canoes of smaller dimensions, hollowed from the trunks of single trees, were used in warfare, fishing, and in general inter-island communication. After the final suspension of intercourse in the 12th century between the Hawaiian and Society Islands, the possible result of the disappearance of a guiding line of small islands and atolls dotting the ocean at intervals between the two groups, the barges referred to gradually went out of use with the abandonment of voyages to distant lands, and were almost unknown to the Hawaiians as early as 1 or 2 centuries ago. Their spread of sail was very considerable, but oars were also used, and the mariner shaped his course by the sun and stars and was guided to land by the flights of birds, drifting wood, and currents of which he knew the direction. Some of the double canoes with which the barges were supplanted were scarcely less capacious and seaworthy than the barges themselves. They were hollowed from the trunks of gigantic pines that had drifted to the islands from the northern coast of America. And when one was found, years sometimes elapsed before wind and current provided a proper mate. One of the single-trunk double canoes of Kamehameha I was 108 feet in length, and both single and double canoes of from 50 to 80 feet in length were quite common during his reign, when the native force abounded in growths much larger than can now be found. But the native trees never furnished bodies for the larger sizes of canoes. They were the gifts of the waves, and were not unfrequently credited to the favor of the gods. Kaupeepee was delighted with the present of the barge. It gave him one of the largest vessels in all the 8 Hawaiian seas, and rendered him especially formidable in sea encounters. He painted the sails red and the hull to the waterline, and from the masthead flung a saucy pennon to the breeze, surmounted by a kahili, which might have been mistaken for Von Trump's broom had it been seen a few centuries later in northern seas. He provided a large crew of oarsmen, and made a more secure landing for it in one of the openings near the fortress. With this substantial addition to his fleet, Kaupeepee enlarged the scope of his depredations, and his red sails were known and feared on the neighboring coasts of Oahu and Maui. Haupu was filled with the spoil of his expeditions, and the return of a successful raiding party was usually celebrated with a season of feasting, singing, dancing, and other boisterous merriment. Nor were the gods forgotten. Frequent festivals were given to Kane, Ku, and Lono, and Moa'ali'i, the shark god of Molokai, the god of the fisherman and mariner, was always the earliest to be remembered. A huge image of this deity overlooked the ocean from the north wall of the heiau of Haupu, and leis of fresh flowers adorned its shoulders whenever a dangerous expedition departed or returned. On one occasion, this god had guided Kaupeepee to Haupu during a dark and rainy night, and on another had capsized a number of Oahuan war canoes that had adroitly separated him from his fleet in Bailolo Channel. At that period, the islands were generally ruled by virtually independent district chiefs. They recognized a supreme head, or Ali'i Nui, but were absolute lords of their several territories, and wars between them were frequent. But they were wars of plunder rather than of conquest, and sometimes continued in a desultory way until both parties were impoverished, when their chiefs and priests met and arranged terms of peace. But Kaupeepe was inspired by a motive higher than that of mere plunder. He hated the southern chiefs and their successors, and his assaults were confined exclusively to the territories over which they ruled. His sole aim was to inflict injury upon them, and the spoils of his expeditions were distributed among his followers. Brave, generous, and sagacious, he was almost worshipped by his people, and treason with them was a thing unthought of. It was, indeed, a wild and reckless life that Kaupeepe and his daring associates led. But it lacked neither excitement abroad nor amusement at home. On the upper terrace, a kahua channel had been cut, along which they rolled the maika and threw the blunted dart. They played konane, puhenehene, and punipeki, and at surf riding possessed experts of both sexes who might have traveled far without finding their equals. The people of the island were friendly with the dashing buccaneers, and the fairest damsels became their wives, some of them living with their husbands at Haupu, and others with their relatives in the valleys. Section 2. We will now return to Hina, or Ho'oho, as she was sometimes called, the beautiful wife of Hakalanileo, nephew of Paumakua of Hawaii. Hakalanileo had acquired his possessions in Hilo, partly through the influence of his own family, and partly through his marriage with the sister of a consequential district chief. Later in life, he had seen and become enamored with Hina, the daughter of Uli, and prevailed upon her to become his wife. The marriage was not acceptable to Uli. The position and family connections of Hakalanileo were sufficiently inviting. But Uli, who dealt in sorcery and magic, saw disaster in the proposed union and advised her daughter against it. After much persuasion, however, her consent was obtained, but she gave it with this injunction. Since you will have it so, take her, Hakalanileo. But guard her well, for I can see that someday the winds will snatch her from you and you will behold her not again for many years. Be it even as you say, replied Hakalanileo. I will take the hazard. We do not well to reject a treasure because perchance it may be stolen. Hina shall be my wife. And thus it was that Hina became the wife of the nephew of Paumakua. Hina, the most beautiful maiden in all Hawaii. Hina, whose eyes were like stars, and whose hair fell in waves below the fringes of her bow. Hina, whose name has come down to us through the centuries, garlanded with song. And for years, she lived happily with Hakalanileo, who loved her above all others. Lived with him until she became the mother of two sons, Kana and Niheu. And then the wind snatched her away from her husband, just as Uli had predicted 6 years before. But the winds that bore her hence filled the sails of the great barge of Kaupeepe. The chief of Haupu had heard of her great beauty, and resolved to see with his own eyes what the bards had exalted in song. Traveling overland from Puna in disguise, he reached her home in Hilo, and saw that the poets had done her no more than justice. She was beautiful indeed, and the wife of one to whose blood he had vowed undying enmity. Returning to Puna, where his barge lay in waiting for him, he hovered around the coast of Hilo for some days, watching for an opportunity to seize the woman whose charms had enraptured him. At last, it came. After sunset, when the moon was shining, Hina repaired to the beach with her women to bathe. A signal was given. It is thought by the first wife of Hakalanileo. And not long after, a light but heavily manned canoe dashed through the surf and shot in among the bathers. The women screamed and started for the shore. Suddenly, a man leaped from the canoe into the water. There was a brief struggle, a stifled scream, a sharp word of command, and a moment later, Kaupeepe was again in the canoe with a nude and frantic Hina in his arms. The boatmen knew their business, knew the necessity of quick work, and without a word, the canoe was turned and driven through the surf like an arrow. The barge, with a man at every oar and the sails ready to hoist, was lying a short distance out at sea. A speck of light guided the boatmen, and the barge was soon reached, All were hastily transferred to it. The sails were spread, the men bent to their oars, the canoe was taken in tow, and while the alarm drum was sounding and fires were appearing on shore, Hina, wrapped in folds of soft kapa, sat sobbing in one of the apartments of the barge and was being swiftly borne by wind and oar toward the fortress of Haupu. The return to Haupu occupied a little more than 2 days. During that time, Hina had mourned continually and partaken of no food. Kaupeepee had treated her with respect and kindness, but she was bewildered with the shock of her abduction and begged to be either killed or returned to her children. The party landed a little before daylight. The sea was rough, but the moon shone brightly, and the passage into the mouth of one of the gulches was made without accident. In the arms of Kaupeepee, Hina was borne up the rock-hewn path to the fortress, and placed in apartments on the lower terrace provided with every comfort and luxury known to the nobility of the islands at that period. They had been especially prepared for her reception, and women were in attendance to wait upon her and see that she wanted for nothing except her liberty. The large private room of the three communicating apartments, the one designed for her personal occupation, was a model of barbaric taste and comfort. And to its adornment, many of the exposed districts of Oahu and Maui had unwillingly contributed. Its walls were tapestried with finely woven and brilliantly colored mattings, dropping from festoons of shells and underlapping a carpet of hardier material covering the level ground floor. The beams of the ceiling were also studded with shells and gaudily stained. On one side of the room was a slightly raised platform, thickly strewn with dry seagrass and covered with many folds of kapa. This was the kapa moe, or sleeping couch. Opposite was a kapa-covered lounge, extending along the entire side of the room. In the middle of the apartment were spread several thicknesses of mats, which served alike for eating and lounging purposes. Light was admitted through two small openings immediately under the eaves, and from the door when its heavy curtains were looped aside. On a row of shelves in a corner of the room were carved calabashes and other curious drinking vessels, as well as numerous ornaments of shells, ivory, and feathers. And in huge calabashes under them were stores of female attire of every description then in use. In fact, nothing seemed to be wanting, and in spite of her grief, Hina could scarcely repress a feeling of delight as she was shown into the apartment and the kukui torches displayed its luxurious appointments. Declining food, Hina dismissed her attendants and, throwing herself on the kapa moe, was soon folded in the soft mantle of sleep and carried back in dreams to the home from which she had been ravished. The room was dark and she slept for many hours. Awaking, she could not for a moment recollect where she was. But gradually the events of the preceding 3 days came to her, and she appreciated that she was a prisoner in the hands of Kaupeepee, of whose name and exploits she was not ignorant, and that repining would secure her neither liberation nor kind treatment. Therefore, with the sagacity to be expected of the daughter of Uli, and not without a certain feeling of pride as she reflected that her beauty had inspired Kaupeepee to abduct her, she admitted her attendance, attired herself becomingly, partook heartily of a breakfast of fish, poi, potatoes, and fruits, and then sent word to Kaupeepee that she would be pleased to see him. Kaupeepee expected a storm of tears and reproaches as he entered the room, but was agreeably disappointed. Hina rose, bowed, and waited for him to speak. "What can I do for you?" inquired Kaupeepee in a kindly tone, while a just perceptible smile of triumph swept across his handsome face. "Liberate me," replied Hina promptly. "You are free to go anywhere within the walls of Haupu," returned Kaupeepee, moving his arms around as if they embraced the whole world. "Return me to my children," said Hina, and at thought of them her eyes flashed with earnestness. "Impossible," was the firm reply. "Then kill me," exclaimed Hina. "Did you ever see me before I had the pleasure of embracing you in the water on the coast of Hilo?" inquired the chief evasively. No, replied Hina curtly. Well, I saw you before that time, continued Kaupeepee. Saw you in your house. Saw you among the palms. Saw you by the waters. I made a journey overland from Puna to see you, to see the wife of my enemy, the most beautiful woman in Hawaii. Hina was but a woman, and of a race and time when the promptings of the heart were not fettered by rigid rules of propriety. Kaupeepee was the handsome and distinguished son of a king, and his words of praise were not unpleasant to her. She therefore bent her eyes to the floor and remained silent while he added, Hina would think little of the man who would risk his life to possess himself of such a woman, and then kill or cast her off as not worth the keeping. You are like no other woman. I am like no other man. Such companionship has the approval of the gods, and you will leave Haupu only when its walls shall have been battered down and Kaupeepee lies dead among the ruins. To this terrible declaration, Hina could offer no reply. The fierceness of this prince of the old line of Nanaula, this enemy of her people, this scourge of the southern chiefs, alike charmed and frightened her. And with her hands to her face, she sank upon the lounge of kapa beside which she had been standing. The chief regarded her for a moment, perhaps with a feeling of pity. Then, placing his hand upon her shoulder, he softly said, You will not be unhappy in Haupu. Will the bird sing that is covered with a calabash? Replied Hina, raising her eyes. I am your prisoner. Not more my prisoner than I am yours, rejoined the chief gallantly. Therefore, as fellow prisoners, let us make the best of walls that shut out no sunshine, and of gates that are a bar only against intrusion. How brave, and yet how gentle, mused Hina, as Kaupeepee, feeling that he had said enough, turned and left the room. How strangely pleasant are his words and voice. No one ever spoke so to me before. I could have listened longer. After that, Hina hearkened for the footsteps of Kaupeepee and lived to forget that she was a prisoner in the fortress of Haupu. His love gently wooed her thoughts from the past and made sweet the bondage which he shared with her.
Black Clock Audio Tales is edited and produced by D.B. Spitzer in Badger's Drift Studios in Portland, Oregon. You can contact us at pgttcm.com, on Facebook at Black Clock Audio Tales, and just look for us, Black Clock Audio Tales. Thank you.